tempting to say James chapter 1. Linda didn't let us, but that's okay. It was great to hear us all read scripture together, wasn't it? I don't know the last time where I was in a room full of women and we read a verse together. It was just lovely. So let's try and memorize this verse, test each other, read it out at home, teach children. If you have children in the house, you can teach them. Let's put it to memory together and be able to recall it when we need it. So as we look at this passage tonight, I wonder, first of all, have any of you been on holiday recently where you have maybe seen a white sheet on the pavement? You've maybe seen some lovely designer handbags on the white sheet on the pavement, and maybe you've been quite wowed by the lovely gentleman who's maybe wanted to bring you over, lure you over, to have a look at the lovely handbags on the white sheet, and maybe he's offered you a very good price for the bag that's on the white sheet, and a price that really doesn't match up with the price that maybe they were in the department store earlier that you were in for the same thing. And maybe, like me, you start to stop and look, which we never ever should do in these situations. We should always just walk on and pretend we didn't see the man and his white sheet and the bags. But I look sometimes, and I make that error, and then I see it, I want it, and I take it, just like Eve in the Garden of Eden. And so all of a sudden I'm home with my new bag, and I'm moving everything that I lug around in my other handbag for no real reason into my new handbag that then I will lug around with me for no real reason other than in case there's some sort of hurricane or some sort of natural disaster that I would have everything that we need in my Mary Poppins bag. So we're delighted with our new purchase, and we start to see how many people will notice it. And as we maybe inspect it after wearing it for a while, the leather strap starts to wear back, doesn't it? The lovely leather strap starts to wear back, and we start to see this white plastic that really shouldn't be there if it is what it says it is. And we maybe look on closer inspection and see that the K on our Michael Kors bag is actually an R, and we have a Michael Roars bag, or the Chanel bag is actually a Chanel bag. And so we're starting to maybe doubt the authenticity of our bag. We're starting to doubt if it's really what it says it is. And if you want to know more about these kinds of bags, if you're not planning any holidays, Linda would be able to share with you a great story of how she's been able to find websites that sell these bags that are at really good prices for real Michael Kors bags. And some of the bags might not come. They might not arrive, but the money will go out of your account. And money that maybe you didn't agree to pay will go out of your account as well. And the bank might have to investigate it for fraud. But if you need to know more about that, you can ask Linda later. But anyway, we get these good deals, don't we? We get the deal that's maybe too good to be true. And maybe it's on eBay. Maybe it's your UGG boots. And maybe you think, this is great. I wonder how many people will notice that they're not real. But how do we know if something's real? We have to look at it up close, don't we? We have to test it. We have to wear it down after a few months maybe of wear. And we start to see that actually it's not real. We compare it with the real thing, and we notice the differences. And so anything that's valuable must be carefully examined to determine if it's really genuine. And so we value these things like bags and shoes, but isn't the most valuable thing that we own our faith? Our most valuable thing is our saving faith. That is our most precious gift that we've received from God. And this promise of eternity in heaven, nothing compares to the worth of our faith. So to be deceived by these counterfeit goods, we might have some sort of temporal loss. But to be deceived by our faith, a counterfeit faith, results in an eternal tragedy. And the world can notice sometimes the difference between someone who's got genuine faith and someone who maybe just professes to be a Christian, especially maybe under times of trial. And that's what we're going to look at in this whole book, this letter from James, about true faith. How do we know our faith is real? And in this first section of this letter, he teaches us that how we handle trouble, how we handle the heat of life, the pressures of life, reveals whether our faith is real or not. So tonight I want us to see that a true Christian woman is steadfast under trial, because true faith is steadfast, and it's the evidence of whether our faith is real or whether it's fake. So as we look at James chapter 1, we're going to see that this steadfast heart under trial is the evidence that our faith is really real, that we have true faith. So we're going to look firstly at verses 1 to 3, and we're going to see that the woman of faith pursues joy under trial. And the context is that James, you maybe have read this in your book, that James is the half-brother of Jesus, which is interesting when then you read the first verse. James doesn't reference this at all. And in many ways, I would have liked him to, because there's millions of Jameses it could have been, but the scholars have narrowed it down and said it is most likely to have been James, the half-brother of Jesus. He's a half-brother because his father wasn't the same dad. Has everybody got that? So it was confusing to me when I first heard it. So he didn't write down James, Jesus' brother, probably shared a room with him, shared toys, fought with him growing up. Maybe Jesus didn't fight because he was perfect. But he knew him. He knew him well. And he didn't immediately start up for that because he's a humble man and he's not going to boast about his credentials. So he comes in and he says, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, a servant. So he actually, rather than boast about his links with Jesus, he goes the opposite and he says, I'm a servant, which actually means doulos, which means a slave. So I'm actually a slave to Christ. What humility. James also was known as James the Just, meaning that he was wise, made good choices, and cared about others and making wise decisions for them. He also was known as Camel Knees because he spent so much time in intercessory prayer for others that his knees started to take on the likeness of a camel, leathery in appearance. And so he was a prayerful man, a humble man, and he was a wise man. And the book doesn't talk a lot about who Jesus was or his ministry. He doesn't reference Jesus an awful lot, but there are a lot of references to the Sermon on the Mount. So he was there, and he heard the Sermon on the Mount, and he references it quite a lot. And this book of James is probably the first book that was written out of all the New Testament books. So he says then, my brothers and sisters, if you read the footnotes, so we're included, the women are included, and he's writing to these Jewish scattered Christians, and he sees them as family. And he's writing to them to show them and teach them what true faith looks like under the persecution that they were facing, under the pressures of life that they were under. And he first of all commands them. What does he say? He says, count it pure joy. So he's saying, you must consider it. You must make a judgment. It's a mental judgment. You must make this judgment about your trials to count it. And what is it? It is the whole of life. Everything that's happened in the past, everything that you're in the present, and everything that's going to happen in the future. Count it pure joy. So all joy, complete joy. Not a fake joy or a contrived or a surfacey joy, not happiness that's based on our circumstances, but an inner contentment. So it's not just act joyfully, but to be genuinely joyful, which is a matter of the will rather than how we feel most of the time. So this joy isn't the natural human response to what's going on in our lives when we suffer and face trials. And if you're like me, you see them as trials and things that come into our lives that are unwelcome, as inconveniences at times, or tragic accidents. This shouldn't happen. This shouldn't be how it is. And so it's not calling on a feeling where we should be happy when we face trials, but that we can rejoice based on a spiritual judgment that we make with our minds. So when you meet trials of many kinds, he tells us this is when we're to have this pure joy. When we're to count it pure joy, when you meet trials, you will meet trials, basically, it's then, it's inevitable. I think we'll all agree that tonight it's inevitable. It's to be expected that trouble will come. Suddenly, things can change in a flash. And this word trial is the word for testing, like what was used to test genuine worth of gold, currency, diamonds, that testing that you put these things through to see if they're real. That's what the word for trials means. And then it says trials of many kinds, meaning multicolored. Basically, diverse. And many of you ladies know much better than me the diversity of trials that can come upon one woman in their life. In a short period of time, trials can come in waves. And in each season, there's trials. We may think that the next stage will be better or it will get better. And so, for example, you maybe have a couple who get married and they decide that they're ready to try for a baby. And they say it'll be better maybe if we have our own family. But then there can be trouble getting pregnant, and it's outside of our control, and that is really hard. Or they say it'll be better then to be pregnant, but then maybe they fall pregnant, and pregnancy can be hard when you go through different complications, whenever things can go wrong, when there's difficulty even just being pregnant and the physical effects of that, it's not easy. They say it'll be better when the baby's out. Let's just get through this. But then you've got to go through labour, don't you? You've got to go through the pain of the curse. And that's hard. And then the baby arrives and there's all sorts of trials. We say it'll be better when they hit the next stage, don't we? It'll be better when they can walk. It'll be better when they can sleep. It'll be better when they eat real food. It'll be better when they can communicate. It'll be better at the next stage because then life will get easier. And it's still so hard. And then they say it'll be better when they're older and they go to school and I can have peace and quiet at last. I have said that possibly 100 times, maybe in the last week. But that's what we say. It'll be better when they get to the next stage. But then you've all the outside influences, don't you, of school, and you've got homework and pressures and running them about to everything, and this season's hard. And you say it might be better when they can drive and look after themselves, but then you don't really want them out driving, do you, on their own? Where are they? Why are they not home yet? Who's in the car with them? Why do they need so much money? Why are they making wrong choices? I wouldn't have picked those friends for them. I wouldn't have picked that relationship. But you're silenced because you decided that you wanted them to grow up and be independent. It's hard. And then you say it'll be better when they leave the nest and just settle down for themselves and we can have our life back. But then you wonder, how are they? I haven't been in touch recently. Wonder what they're doing. And then you don't even need to get started on girlfriends, boyfriends, fiancés, wedding stresses, in-laws, grandchildren. You see how the trials can just come and come. We think it'll be better at the next stage, but the trials can come with every single season, and life is hard. So think about your aspects of life where life can be hard. Think about maybe where you have been subject to the sin of others, where you have been subject to your own sin and choices. And maybe just being subject to living in a fallen world where things just don't go to plan. These things can affect our marriage, they can affect our wider family, they can affect our work, our health, our friendships, our money, or lack thereof. And so from our childhood home to our retirement home, trials are constant. And I think we can agree that as many women that are here tonight, there are as many trials, if not more. And so even sometimes good things can have a natural difficult part, can't they? A new chapter maybe starting, goodbyes at an airport that are exciting for one but yet hard for another. Maybe someone that wants to go and be a missionary and you're excited for what they're going to be involved in but yet you don't really want them to leave and be vulnerable. Maybe a relationship that's had to break up that's actually for the better but it's still hard. Or maybe the death of a loved one who'd suffered for a long time. It's still hard even though they are no longer suffering. And so small things can be trials and big things can be trials. Even in the hour and a half before leaving to come here tonight, we had mini trials, which I call them, that all add up to become one big kind of explosion at times. We had whining. We had the printer didn't work. We had an accusation that we had dinged someone's car in the car park, which we didn't. But we had all these things. And then we had the gas salesman. There's SSE electricity around the doors tonight. And so we had them at the door when we were about to leave. You have all these things that add up and add pressure to life. But then there's also the big things. The big things that can come unexpected. Maybe a sense of loss. Loss of a person. Loss of control. Loss of security, comfort, relationship. A dream or a hope. Maybe the loss of approval from other people. Maybe the loss of peace, identity, or ability. Or a trial that you might be in might be a season of waiting. Waiting for healing. Waiting for a relationship. Waiting for a family. Waiting for a job. And the light of the hope is slowly dimming before your eyes. So for all of us, we will face trials. Our life is a place of constant testing. Our hearts are under trial. Peace is rare, if not totally abnormal, and trials are the norm. So we can agree that we will expect trials, but then James tells us in verse 3, why can we have joy? For you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. So no matter how hot a fire is, if you put pure gold in there, the gold will stay, it will remain, and you will know it's real, you will know it's pure. So no matter how hard our trials are, true Christians remain holding on to their faith, maybe even by their fingertips, if we're really honest. So what this is saying is that there's a stamp of approval for real Christians under trial. The stamp of approval is steadfastness, this perseverance. So trials plus real faith equal steadfastness. So what is this steadfastness? What is this perseverance? You looked it up in the definition, hopefully, in your homework with your dictionaries. Some of you were maybe using dictionary apps. Some of you maybe had to go and dust off the dictionary from 1970-something. But we had to look up and see, what did this word mean? And there's lots of different definitions. It talks about being firm, unwavering, fixed, persistent. And really, if you look back in the Greek, the word means to remain under. To remain under with patient endurance of expectancy and hope. So it's not a passive thing. It's not where you just grit your teeth and bear it and you just let it pass around you. But it's an active endurance, staying power, like stickability, where you persevere, where you are steadfast. And so these things that come, that test our faith, they prove it. The things that test our patience produce it. And only trials can produce this virtue of steadfastness. Wearsby said, will trials make us bitter or will they make us better? And naturally when we suffer trials, we can start to live like what's known as practical atheists. So a practical atheist is someone who says they believe in God, that he's in control, that we love him. But when the trials come, the storms come, we ask, why is this happening? What is going on? Whose fault is this? You try to blame maybe other people. Take things into your own hands maybe. Grumble and complain, or maybe become fearful and anxious and self-pitying without considering who God is. We respond as if God doesn't exist. We respond like we're practical atheists. But this bitter impatience or anxious fear as a response is the opposite of a steadfast heart, a heart of joy and a heart of perseverance. No one wants or likes trials. And some people think that Christianity means that we have an easy life because we've got access to God, which I don't know where they get that from if they read Hebrews 11. So our God is not the God of the easy life, but he is the God of proving himself faithful again and again, and as the anchor of our souls to enable us to persevere under trial, not just to remove us from them. So how do trials make us better? And why on earth can we count it a joy? Well, I believe the answer is in the start of verse 3. It says, for you know, so we must know. We don't judge by our feelings, because at times our feelings can lie. Our feelings can lead us to sorrow, anxiety, bitterness, but we need to judge what we know to be true. Someone gave me advice one time and they said, talk to yourself, don't just listen. So yes, we acknowledge how we're feeling, but we don't just listen to how we're feeling and live by that. We need to talk truth to ourselves, speak to ourselves, correct any lies, acknowledge how we're feeling, but then speak truth back to ourselves. So what do we need to know then to have joy under trial? We need to know, first of all, to expect trials of all kinds. So when miseries come in waves at times on our life, we're not surprised because we know to expect them. Jesus said, John 16:33, in this life you will have tribulation. And then secondly, we need to know that our trials are purposeful, don't we? We need to remind ourselves that our trials are purposeful. Purposeful in producing steadfastness, which makes us complete. Purposeful in showing us that our faith is real. Do you know, I used to think that trials, God was testing us in trials to kind of figure us out, to get to know us better, to see if he, you know, could test us and see if we really loved him and if our faith was real. But then I remember, but God knows everything. God knows all about us. He doesn't need to test us for his own knowledge. He tests us to reveal our faith and our hearts to ourselves and to others around us. And so their trials are purposeful in producing steadfastness, purposeful in showing us that our faith is either real or not. And then purposeful in drawing us closer to God. So these trials at times can expose our sin. They can reveal our need for God when we've tried to maybe take control for ourselves and our need for a Savior. So there's lots of reasons why we can be reminding ourselves daily at times, if not throughout the day, that trials have purpose. So just to be clear, James isn't telling us just cheer up. It'll all work out. Don't worry about it. Relax. It's all going to be fine. Put on your happy face. And he's not telling us to be fake and pretend that things are okay. Because if someone comes to me and says, I'm going through this, this, and this, but it's fine, I'm counting it a joy. I just am so glad I'm here. I'm so glad I'm in this place in my life. It's just wonderful. I'm a bit concerned because that doesn't seem very real to me. But if somebody comes and says, this is hard. It's probably the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my life, or these little things, these little pressures are all adding up, and it's hard at times to keep perspective. But I'm choosing that God has a purpose. I'm choosing that I can't not expect trials in my life. Then I know that joy is real. I know that person is trusting in what God is saying and not faking it in many ways. So let me ask us this evening, how is our faith faring under trial at the moment? Are we better or are we bitter? Or are we pretending to be fine? When we're squeezed under the pressure of life, what seeps out of us? Is it pure joy that overflows from our steadfast heart? Or does our faith simply collapse? Are we practical atheists and we're bitter and anxious? Many of you women know from your own experience or maybe the experience of others that trials can make us bitter or better over many years. Or maybe you've seen how perseverance has been cultivated over many years with people that you know or in your own life. And maybe no one can understand your trial, your specific trial, but God does. And he gives us good reasons why we can count it pure joy. So James is saying that a woman of faith pursues joy under trial because they expect trials and they embrace them as beneficial because they remember that God has a purpose in them. So he says we can be joyful because steadfastness is being produced. But verse 3 is then sown to verse 4. If you look at verse 4, by this word perseverance or steadfastness, depending on your version. And really this is saying that it's not a product. The steadfastness isn't a product of our trials, but it's a process that we then go through. So secondly, the woman of faith perseveres under trial. They persevere under trial. So James is saying, and let steadfastness. So he's not saying it produces steadfastness, just wait for it to happen, it'll all happen miraculously. No, he said, and let steadfastness, allow steadfastness to have its full effect. So we're to allow it to happen. And at times it's easy to get started in a trial and go, no, this is fine, I'm okay, we're going to persevere here. And then it just keeps coming. And it's hard. And we maybe just want to resign from the race altogether and just find quick relief and get out. But it's saying, be submissive to the work of steadfastness. Allow the work to do its work in its life, in your life. And so patience is what we need at times, but perseverance continues through a trial and it produces something as the outcome. And it has this full effect, it says. It's a process towards an end. And in your homework you looked up what this word perfect means. It means without flaw, doesn't it? That's the goal. When we're fully developed, we're mature, complete, and lacking in nothing. So trials give us opportunity to develop this perseverance, which when its work is complete, makes us completely complete as Christian women. And this helps us keep going, doesn't it? So there's a man in our house who will remain nameless, who is prone not just to sickness, but to the possibility that sickness is looming. And often I hear the words, I think something's brewing, or I think this cough is moving down into my chest, or I think this tooth is getting sore again, better call Dave the dentist, get some antibiotics just in case. So he is familiar oftentimes with being told you must finish the course of antibiotics. And in the same way, this passage is teaching us that we must finish the course of perseverance. We can't give up. Oftentimes, like our antibiotics, we start taking them because we feel so rotten, and then the symptoms start to disappear, and we feel okay, so we just stop taking them. But then, sure enough, the infection's back, and we're back in square one again. So in the same way, we must finish the course of perseverance. God must complete his work with our cooperation. And really, I want to challenge us tonight, because our greatest desire as Christians should be this perfection, should be to be perfect as an image of Christ. But I often fear that we're sidetracked at times. We're enticed by lesser, maybe more attainable goals, where we just want comfort. We just want approval from other people. We just want a sense of control over things. And if these things are the goal of our lives, then we won't be steadfast under trial. We won't count it a joy. We won't persevere. And we won't be changed to be mature. And so we must take responsibility for this response that we have to our trials. We mustn't give up when things get tough so that steadfastness can have its full effect. So in your homework you were asked, how would developing perseverance change the way you live? Just think about that. Reflect on that later. Think about what you wrote. Where are your trials taking you? Many of you girls maybe have been through exams recently or are studying for exams, and I remember having exams a long time ago, and I remember doing a lot of comprehension, which was similar to our homework, wasn't it? Comprehension, who remembers that? And so comprehension was great, but hard. And so when you think back to those times of exams, you had to maybe endure sitting indoors with the lovely weather like we had today. It's typical. It's always at exam time. And you had maybe your revision timetable marked out and stuck to the wall, and you were very diligent to colour that in very well. And you spent a long time revising, basically colouring in your revision timetable. And so when anyone asked, you're like, yes, I'm working away. Just got the highlighters out. And so you looked forward to maybe to a day that you had highlighted on your timetable where it was all stars and dancing, the day when the exams would be over, didn't you? That was the goal. We want to get to that day, because then you're free. You're free from studying. You're free from being hunkered down at a desk where you can't lift your head and look out the window because it's sunny outside. And you know that there's a day coming when the work will be done. And hopefully another day will come that maybe we don't look forward to so much, but it would be good if we can get rewarded for our perseverance in our study, a day of results. And so those goals, those days are what help us to remain under, don't they? The joy that's ahead when we're free and we're finished, when we can just sit and think, I have nothing to do. And then we get to the point where we don't know what to do with ourselves, because we've been studying so hard, we have this newfound freedom and we don't know what to do, but we can fill it quite quickly. So it's intense at times, it's hard going, it can be lonely at times when we're remaining under, when we're persevering, but we do have joy ahead. And we can hope in that, and we can have motivation and that inspiration to keep going, because there will be purpose in our trials, and that's what keeps us persevering. And there will be a day of reward. So we naturally will maybe slip up at times when we think about studying. I didn't have Facebook in my day, but maybe you go on Facebook to take a break, and all of a sudden half an hour's gone, and you're not studying anymore. There's days where we slip up at times. But it's not about perfection, is it? It's about what direction are you going? What are you characterized? Are you characterized by perseverance? Are you persevering as a characteristic of your life, even though at times it can be hard and we may slip up? Even though we might not see the results to our trials that we want, we keep going, even though we struggle. So when we leave tonight, we might face trials of many kinds. You might go back to the waiting room. You might go back to that sense of loss. You might return to trials that have been going on for years. Maybe you'll face trials that are in a phone call that might change your world forever. Trials that maybe won't change until this life is over. What direction are you travelling in? Are you persevering? Are you following the path of perseverance? Are you stuck in a ditch? Are you stuck in a ditch of bitterness or hopelessness or impatience? So what's the secret? How can we count it a joy? How can we persevere? Let's look at the end of verse 4. It says, lacking in nothing. And this should be our goal. This should be our hope, that we lack nothing. But I'm aware very much that I lack a lot. And in the tangle of circumstances at times that come with trials, this purposeless mess that seems to overcome us, it shows me that I lack control. I lack power. I lack understanding at times. I lack patience. I lack joy. I lack perseverance. And I lack perspective. And maybe you do too. But this word lack links us then into our next point. We lack wisdom. So let's look at verse 5. And in true Baptist fashion, and Johnny would be so proud of me, I have 3 points that all start with a P. The woman of faith prays expectantly under trial. So James is telling us that this is the how. How do you do it all? How do you have joy? How do you have perseverance? You need wisdom. So we all lack wisdom. If any of you lacks wisdom, hands up, we all lack wisdom, don't we? We need to therefore all ask God. And you looked up a definition for wisdom in your homework, hopefully. And we understood that wisdom is not just knowledge. It's not just learning. It's not just information that we can gather up. But we looked at it and we discovered that wisdom is a right judgment based on knowledge and perspective. It's a right judgment based on knowledge and perspective. So wisdom is different from knowledge, because knowledge is like checking the weather forecast and saying that it's going to rain. But wisdom is bringing an umbrella. Okay? Okay, Sharon wants it again. So knowledge checks the weather forecast, checks it and says it's going to rain. Barabbas is telling us it is going to rain. But wisdom remembers to bring the umbrella. Do you see the difference? Yeah. So it's not just building up a knowledge and being a know-it-all, just beholding, but wisdom. We want to be changed. We want to make right choices and have right decisions and right perspectives in our trials. So wisdom helps us to grow in maturity, and we need it. We need it desperately, especially in trials. So it says, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach. This is a divine command. If we want knowledge, we can find it outside of God. If we want wisdom, we must ask God for it. But we must ask in faith with no doubting. And if we doubt, there's danger, isn't there? Danger of being double-minded and unstable. So who was confused about the two minds in their homework? Mind one and mind two. Everyone? Right, we're going to explain it. So the double-minded man. So if you have a mind that's double-minded, you have double means two. You have two minds. And so mind one, which really, I'm sorry about this, you should have had maybe a bit more of an explanation, but it was based on the passage. And really what mind one, for example, is the mind that is steadfast, that trusts God. And then mind two is the mind that doubts. Okay, does that make sense? So the mind that trusts God, that is steadfast, is stable, is steadfast. It asks in faith. Those are the things that we could have written down there. Don't worry if you got it wrong. We're not going to mark them, don't worry. And then the mind that doubts is unstable, is tossed by the waves, is confused, and God does not answer their prayer for wisdom. Does that make sense? So really, what we're saying is that the person who is in faith, they are steadfast, they are anchored and steady in the storm. But if you don't have your anchor, if you don't have your faith, then you're going to be tossed by the winds. And so even though you may have an anchor, the waves will come, the wind will come, and it may hurt in the trials, but you're anchored. You don't move around wondering if you really believe who God is and who he says he is. Does that make sense? So if we're to be steadfast, then we need to be anchored in our faith when we ask. So when we are asking, when we're squeezed under the pressures of life, do you simply want answers? Do you want God to tell you what to do? Or do you want wisdom? And what area of life are you maybe double-minded? And so James then reminds us quickly that we have to remember the character of God. We need to remember that God gives generously. And that's something I want us to dwell on over the next week, perhaps, that it will be given to him. It says at the end of verse 5, it will be given to him if he asks in faith. So we need to behold, we need to have a right view of God. That's why we're here. We're making lodgments into our account, the savings account, through our study of the Bible, so that we can understand who God is, so that whenever then the trials come, we can then debit from our investment of that we know who God is. We know that he's faithful. We know that he gives generously when we ask for wisdom. And he doesn't tell us off. He doesn't reprimand us. He loves us, and he gave a son for us. And that is the reason why we can come to him and ask for wisdom, which he generously gives. So we all lack wisdom. God will give it to us, but we must ask. So who do you turn to in your trials, is my question. Who do you turn to? Do you turn to other people for their experiences? Do you read the writing of other people? Do you follow everything except his wisdom? The song says, oh, what grace we often forfeit because we don't carry everything to God in prayer. So let's be women that pray for wisdom. James then uses this illustration in verses 9 to 11 to show us that both riches and poverty can bring trial. They also bring opportunity to exercise wisdom. Life doesn't get easier if we get more money. I think we believe that all the time, that if I just had a little bit more, not necessarily loads, but a little bit more, that life would get easier. It certainly doesn't. And then in verse 11, James reminds us this life isn't all there is. And like a flower that withers and fades, our lives are fleeting. And then he circles round to the start again in verse 12 and says, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which is promised to those who love him. So the eternal reward is what we can look forward to as well, isn't it? The crown. The crown that's not a royalty crown, not an inherited crown, but a crown that's a reward, like symbolizing some sort of athletic endeavor, maybe a marathon winner gets the crown, the laurel wreath. And that's our hope. So we can pray expectantly, knowing that God will answer and knowing that we have a crown that awaits us. And we know that Jesus is the perfect example of this, isn't he? He's the man who considered it pure joy. He knew to expect trials. He knew it was the will of the Father to go through trials. He didn't necessarily delight in the circumstances, but he, for the joy who was set before him, endured the cross. He persevered under trial through a sinless life, was completely steadfast to the very, very end. And because he knew and desired that end result, didn't he? He wanted to be complete. The work was complete because of his perseverance. And he prayed expectantly. He prayed with God throughout his whole life with expectant hope. And because he wore the crown of thorns, then we can look forward to that crown of life, can't we? That is our reward. That is the joy that we have before us that we can look forward to. And we won't look forward to that based on how we feel whenever the trials come, but we will because of what we know. And Jesus understands our weaknesses, doesn't he? Because he has lived a life persecuted, tried in many different ways. And it says in Hebrews 4, verses 14 to 16, we can draw near to the throne of grace to find mercy and help in time of need, because Jesus can sympathize with all of our weaknesses and all the different variety that they can come. So as I close, I want us to think of two local women who you will know, Maud Kells and Helen Rosevere. You know these women, hopefully. Both single women, both women that worked in the Congo as missionary women, where their trials are beyond our understanding, certainly beyond my understanding, that they faced. But wasn't their faith proved to be true and real under trial? Helen Rosevere, at the point of being imprisoned for 5 months, being beaten and raped, and more recently Maud Kells being shot by the bandits, who then said, "It has been an honour to work in the Congo all these years. What joy." They both persevered and now are mature. They finished the course of maturity to me. They seem steadfast in their faith. Helen Rosevere now shares her faith with those in her nursing home. Maud Kells says, "I'd like to go back and finish the project we had setting up a wee nursery." What perseverance, when it would have been easy to give up. And I believe that the fuel for their joy, the fuel for their perseverance, was their expectant prayer, where they reminded themselves with wisdom from God of the sure and steady hope that they have of eternity, that helped them to remain steadfast. And I pray that this would be the same for us, that there would be enough evidence of joy in our lives, there would be enough evidence of perseverance in our lives as women of Hamilton Road, where there would be enough prayer, expectant prayer in our lives, that we would be women that could be convicted as women of true faith whenever we face trials of many kinds. So let's just pray together. We're going to pray now, and then we're going to sing two songs in response to what we've heard. And then we're going to have an open time of reflection where we can either write in our journals or books what we've heard and what we've been challenged in our hearts. And then we can share with one another if we want to, or we can pray with one another, or we can pray silently. So let's just take time to quiet after all we've heard and behold who God is and think about how we can become. God, I thank you that you're all-knowing, all-powerful, sovereign over all, and yet you care for us in our problems and our trials and our struggles, and you know them inside out. I thank you that we can trust you, that you're fulfilling your purposes in our trials. And despite our trials, that you're using them for good, that you're molding us into Christ-likeness. And I thank you for this model of steadfastness that you've given us, this model of steadfastness under trial that is Christ, who has redeemed us and strengthens us to stand in the storms that we face when our faith is tested and purified. So help us, God, to become. Help us to become women who look to you for wisdom and your perspective, so we can have joy in our trials, so we can persevere in our trials to the very end, so that we might be complete, mature, lacking in nothing, and receive the eternal crown promised to us because we love you and have proved our love for you by the way we persevere. We pray that we would glorify you as we honour you in our trials, and that our faith would be evident to others as they watch on. It's in in Christ's name that we pray. Amen.